Well, good morning, all. Hey, guess what? We made it to Friday. Congratulations. It's the 26th of September, 30 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we welcome you to the program. I'm Joe Donahue. We have an amazing panel this morning. I want to introduce them, and we'll get started. We're doing just a slightly abbreviated version this morning. We're going to 10:30, and then we're going to hear from CNN's Jake Tapper, who has an amazing new book out, which is called Race Against Terror, Chasing an Al-Qaeda Terrorist at the Dawn of the Forever War. And we'll talk to Jake Tapper at 10:30 this morning. So a busy day and some good stuff. And then Janice Ian will be with Sarah LaDuke coming up in our 11 o'clock hour. So we got a show. This is a show. So we'll get started and we'll move quick. Let me introduce the group to you. Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner. I've said this before. It's one thing to have them come in the first time. It's even better when they actually come back. That is, it just fills me with great hope. And especially when they're so good and so wonderful on the air. Ashley Dittus is the Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner. Good morning, Ashley. It's a delight to have you back.
Good morning, Joe. I'm happy to be here. I think we're going to have a great conversation. Lots to talk about today.
A lot to talk about, indeed. You gave us presents. Very nice. These are the new I Voted stickers.
I did. So hot off the press, we got them this week. They landed our very famous I Voted sticker program that we hold every year in Ulster County, where we invite Ulster County students ages 9 to 18 to participate, submit artwork. We give them a lot of freedom in their creativity and their expression. We had 5 fantastic finalists. And the winner this year, if I could describe it, I know this is a radio show, so you can't see it. You can look at it on our website, voteulster.com, but it is a cartoon image of the Statue of Liberty, but her face has been replaced by a delicious-looking slice of pepperoni pizza. So that is what our Ulster County voters have to look forward to when they start to cast their ballots in less than a month from now. October 25th is the first day for early voting, but I thought I'd bring some for you, Joe, and our panelists today, but you have to promise to vote before you wear it.
Oh, absolutely. It is, it's great. really, and they're very nicely done and nice and shiny.
Local print shop.
Good stuff.
You know, it looks like, I don't know if the NPR crowd is necessarily the Adult Swim crowd on Cartoon Network, but this looks like a character from like Aqua Teen Hunger Force or
it
something.
It does. It reminds me of that sort of style. And the student, Riker, he's a student from Saugerties. This is his... he has this pizza character all over the place. There's a mural in Saugerties with the pizza character on it. His mother has a tattoo of the pizza character, and he's very civically engaged. He will be honoring him in a few weeks at the Ulster County Legislature. He will get the Pride of Ulster Award.
You know, that... and as should the mother, because that is a loving mother to put a tattoo of your son's art. That's good. That's really very, very cool. Congratulations on that. Thank you for sharing and for being with us again. We welcome writer, analyst, recently retired president of Siena University, former New York Congressman Chris Gibson is here. Hello, Chris. How are you? A delight to have you back on the program.
Great to be here, Joe. Thanks so much.
Wonderful to have you here. Aaron Pasitti is—he's a professor there at Siena College. I'm sure you two have met, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. Aaron is awesome.
Siena University professor of economics is Aaron Pasitti, and you've been away for a little bit. It's wonderful to have you back.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been away. It's just I need to take a little bit of time to get my bearings at the start of the semester.
Okay.
My time management skills are kind of chaotic.
I was following some of your concert touring. And I thought that was on Facebook, and that was really interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I go down to New York City as often as I can to see concerts that don't necessarily make it to Albany. So yeah, it was a blast.
Good stuff. Well, it's wonderful to have you here. It's wonderful to have all of you here. We will also welcome you to be a part of the program, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. James Comey was indicted. I have to say, the last time we had James Comey on the show, a while back, and because he started, when he retired, he started writing mystery novels, crime thriller novels. And so when I heard that he was indicted, I thought it was because of his writing. But...
gotcha, Jim.
But no.
Silly you.
Yeah, no, it was something more than that. It is former FBI Director James Comey was indicted Thursday on allegations he lied to Congress, a sign of President Donald Trump's growing influence over the Justice Department amid his extraordinary demands it prosecute a man he has long considered a political foe. The indictment issued by federal grand jury in Alexandria charges Comey with one count of making false statements and one count of obstruction of Congress. Charges punishable by up to 5 years in prison. It was delivered over the objections of career prosecutors who insisted there was insufficient evidence to charge Comey with a crime. Separating now from the Washington Post article, Chris Gibson, this was fascinating to me because the president was looking for someone to do this. He had someone he thought could do it. They didn't do it. He fired them. He got somebody new who was very young. I think I don't use this as a disparaging term, but inexperienced in this particular realm. And there is a statute of limitations that would have gone up, I think, on Tuesday, I believe. So... here we are.
Yeah.
What does this mean?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a process here. I think, having just spent the last couple years looking at asymmetry of power, consolidation of power, I'm not shocked by this. I think this is in part what happens when the imperial presidency gets weaponized. Again, you just for the listeners, in terms of the claims here, this has to do with 2016 investigation of which he was asked about formally in 2020. And the claim is that when he responded to that inquiry, he made a false statement. It's allegedly surrounds a leak to the media. And so we're going to find out whether or not, the statement that he made in 2020 is he had nothing to do with that leak. Kash Patel, when he went in as the FBI director, he claims he found some new files that may shed light on this. Look, you're innocent until proven guilty. It was once said during Watergate, you can, basically indict a ham sandwich. So, so we'll see what happens here in the end. I mean, look, we've seen that in New York State as well. Steve McLaughlin was indicted. And before a jury of his peers, he was found not guilty. So and Joe Bruno, of course. I mean, so there are examples of this. Now we're at the federal level. So Comey is going to have his day in court. And we'll find out on all of this as to whether or not there is new revelations. But, I'm also interested in is accountability. If he was, in fact, guilty, then he'll be held accountable. But if he is not guilty, then is there any accountability to potentially an overreach with this indictment? History would say no, there won't be. There certainly wasn't any consequence when all that taxpayer money was spent on prosecuting McLaughlin and found not guilty. And by the way, that jury returned in like an hour or something like that. So I hope I'm pleasantly surprised that there'll be accountability in one form or another.
Ashley.
Yeah, so this indictment is on 1.5 pieces of paper. It's not a very robust, we really don't know yet what their case will be. But there's a lot of things that are outside of Comey that we should be looking at with this. This is who's next is another reinvigorated the investigation against our Attorney General Letitia James. Obviously, there's a lot of buzz right now about George Soros and diverting DOJ resources. About half a dozen field offices right now are researching George Soros and his foundation. Adam Schiff, the list goes on and on. And so it looks like the DOJ doesn't work for the American people anymore. They work for Donald Trump. The prosecutor who he installed on Monday, as of last week, her main objective was rooting out negative aspects of slavery from our Smithsonian institutions now is this week, within 4 days, bringing charges against one of Donald Trump's biggest political adversaries. His perception, I don't really think that James Comey is as beloved by the left, certainly not after the events of 2016. So it's sort of a curious choice, but he has an obsession with him. And it seems to be that they're placating how he feels more than how the rest of us feel. So this makes us less safe. The DOJ is supposed to be doing lots of work to help the American public be safe. And now we're seeing it taken over by the president, with no check on that. The legislative branch and the courts are also lockstep. So this is a scary thing. It's a constitutional crisis, I think, and it's potentially an impeachable offense, but don't hold your breath and see that happen. And so this is it's really sad. It's really sad to see. And I also, in reading about this, what jumped out to me is that, you know, people that work for the DOJ and the FBI, career prosecutors, career agents, they don't like working there right now. They want to leave. And who's going to replace them but loyalists to the president? And that's just going to make the situation far, far worse going forward.
Aaron Pasitti.
I've got two thoughts on this. One has to do with political theory and the other with psychology. The way Trump governs is what I'm calling the mafia theory of the state, or the Tony Soprano theory of the state, where he rules by intimidation and punishment to show strength. It's largely the politics of vengeance and humiliation against his enemies. He's weaponized the government against any and all opposition. And, you know, the goal here isn't to improve public service or the functioning of American society, get the economy ready, you know, for 21st century manufacturing. But the goal seems to be to, you know, bolster his, as Chris said, imperial presidency by instilling fear in those who might speak out against him. And there's a real there's a real threat that this is going to intensify, because he's not a popular president. If you look at polls, the last one I saw is that, you know, 55% disagreed, 45% agreed. And when you strip out the bases on either side of, like, you know, the MAGA base and then the strong Democratic base, that 10 percentage point gap actually widened. So since he's, you know, not popular, since he's not passing legislation that, you know, fundamentally improves the standard of living for the American public, you know, this is how he goes about it. And this leads into my second point, which is psychological. People who are insecure, people who are bullies, people who are fearful, have defense mechanisms to cope with that. And one way in which they do that is by projecting their own insecurities and fears onto others. So the way I've learned to interpret what Trump says is by, if he says somebody's weaponizing the government against him, what I hear is, I'm going to weaponize the government against this person that poses a threat to my power. So when you see this, the witch hunts, the you know, weaponizing the Department of Justice and the FBI, this is, you know, this is a kind of a classic case of, you know, what Sigmund Freud referred to as just coping mechanisms or defense mechanisms. When you're paranoid, when you're surrounded by people who are sycophants who always tell you, yes, Donald, you're right. Yes, that's a great idea. Yes, that's a great idea. Nobody's trying to rein him in. And the longer that goes on, the, you know, the more ruthless he will be as the Tony Soprano president, and the more likely he is to continue to weaponize the government in ways that can be, you know, very damaging to the long-term health of these political institutions.
Chris?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that. I mean, that's a lot of what Aaron just described is what's on my mind here. Again, I don't want to get ahead of the facts in this particular case, but I do want to sort of abstract and talk about potential consequences. Let's run the scenario that it turns out there's really nothing. These prosecutors said that the reason why they didn't bring the case. So when you consider that, right, from the citizen standpoint, from us, we the people, where's the check? I mean, where's the accountability? Because, you know, as I was listening to you, Aaron, and you were given a description of Donald Trump, it seems to me I heard a fair amount of people here in New York actually ascribe that same description to Andrew Cuomo during the time he was governor. So there seems to be, from our standpoint as citizens, I mean, what if the government overreaches and really impugns your reputation with an indictment that utterly gets thrown out or defeated in a jury verdict, how do you reestablish the reputation of somebody who was never guilty in the first place? So that's what's on my mind. The founders,
crime novels.
Yeah, well, you know, the founders talked about at the Constitutional Convention. They were considering the issue of power and what do we do to keep it in check. And you know, ultimately they concluded that there's no way you're going to stop humans from being humans. So the best way to do this is have transparency, the sunlight, and then accountability through the separation of powers. And so when you take down those checks and balances and separation of power, when we find executives really overreaching, I mean, until we actually reassess, rebalance our republic, we're going to end up with more situations like that. And that's what's on my mind. I appreciated that description both in terms of the specifics, but also the psychological aspects, because I'm viewing it. I'm concerned about where we are.
David writes to us and says, even if the charges against Comey collapse, which I suspect they will in short order, it costs Comey cash. So Kash Patel and the FBI found new files about Comey, but somehow didn't find the Epstein files. Hopefully the judge will throw it out in short order so they don't gouge Comey for hundreds of thousands of dollars at least. That from Dave.
Yeah, I mean, that's my point. So in those circumstances, shouldn't the citizens be able to recover? Shouldn't they, if they're found, you know
point.
What I'm saying? I mean, there has to be some kind of check against this where individuals can they may not be able to fully recover their reputation, even though they were in some cases unjustifiably impugned, but they should be able to recover their financials.
The plaintiff covers the defendant's legal fees if they're found innocent.
And to Ashley's excellent point, this is one name on a very long list of people that are in the queue to go after, let's
exactly.
say. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll change subjects. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Ashley Dittus, Chris Gibson, Aaron Pacitti, making up our panel this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Since it is journalistic law that we must discuss this, here we go. A shutdown is looming. It is a shutdown crisis, as the headlines blare. White House threat of federal layoffs only deepens the shutdown impasse. Democratic leaders said the administration's plan to fire government workers in the event of a shutdown would not prompt them to drop their demands in their spending standoff with the GOP. That from the New York Times. The deadline is Tuesday, October 1st. Aaron Pacitti, one, do you think there will be a shutdown? Two, what should we make of this?
Yeah, I'll take the easy speculative question first. And the answer is I really think that this time around the Democrats aren't going to vote for the spending bill. So I'm going to hedge my bets. I'm 80% certain there'll probably be a shutdown.
Okay.
Which,
I'm not going to hold you to it or anything.
That's fine. Yeah, but Chris Chris over here, he's talking about accountability. And like, if I make these predictions and I'm wrong, like, where's
no,
the accountability?
All right.
I get just angry emails from the readers. So what to make of this? So a government shutdown is what happens when Congress needs to fund legislation to finance previously agreed upon spending from the previous fiscal year. So it's an insane way to govern, and it's has potentially catastrophic could have potentially catastrophic effects on, you know, obviously the functioning of government and providing essential services, but two, on the U.S.'s international standing and the economy as well. So, you know, normally Congress approves a budget, and then they authorize different agencies to spend X amount of dollars. And now we're in a situation where because of the upcoming fiscal year, which starts on October 1st, that additional funding is needed to finance things that Congress already agreed to. So it's a little bit head-scratching. It's a little bit confusing about why our Congress can't get this right. But sadly, shutdowns have become – or the threat of a shutdown has become a way for whatever party is in the minority to bargain for things that they otherwise could not get through the traditional legislative process. So, you know, when Newt Gingrich did it in the 90s with President Clinton, when it happened under President Obama, you've got, you know, Republicans shutting down the voting to shut down the government to get a Democratic president to agree to spending cuts. That seems like you're really holding the whole country and economy hostage to get your preferred political outcomes. So it's not a sane way to govern. It has potentially devastating consequences for, like I said, the economy and society. In terms of what actually happens is that, you know, non-essential workers get furloughed. National defense stays intact, but they don't receive paychecks, and then they get back pay. But essential services and employees, senior citizens getting Social Security checks, you know, having hospital visits by Medicare and Medicaid patients paid for, all of those things will continue. But the threat that Democrats see, and the reason they didn't shut down or vote for a shutdown in, was it March of this year when it came up last, was that they're afraid that by doing so, it gives the president more power to fire more workers, which is just going to further devastate the functioning of the federal government. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because Democrats, and, you know, I've said this many times, because as a panelist on the show, we've covered many shutdowns over the past 10 years or so, and it's not a good way to govern. It doesn't matter whether you've got a Democratic president and a Republican Congress saying we're going to shut down the government unless you slash spending. And I don't think it's a sane way to govern if you've got a Republican president and a Democratic Congress saying we're going to shut down the government if you don't agree to funding for the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid. So as far as I know, we're like the only country in the world that uses the shutdown of the government as political leverage. In terms of the consequences of what this could have, and I'll make this short because I know we're on an accelerated timeline. In previous years when the government's been shut down, the mid-90s was a big one with President Clinton, the mid-teens with President Obama, and then the late teens with President Trump. Those shutdowns had a minimal impact on the economy. It doesn't have a substantial effect. Today's economy is much different than the economy of those previous eras, where you've got extreme amounts of uncertainty, uncertainty surrounding tariffs, uncertainty surrounding deportations and labor shortages, uncertainty around the size of the federal budget deficit because of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. We're on much more fragile footing. The economy is on much thinner ice than it was in the past. So a prolonged shutdown has the potential to kind of tip an already fragile economy even to further levels of fragility, and has the potential to, you know, perhaps push us into a recession, because when you lay off and furlough federal employees, that's the direct effect. Then there's the downstream effects of, well, that affects downtown commercial real estate in Washington, D.C., and that affects the people who own the buildings, and that affects defense contractors and the vendors that supply defense contractors. And if it goes on long enough, I think it has the potential to kind of upend an economy that seems to be, as I said before, skating on really thin ice.
Ashley.
Sure. So this hits close to home. Both myself and my husband are public servants. I work in local government, so for Ulster County. But my husband, Dan, he works for Congressman Pat Ryan. So he is a federal employee. When the government shuts down, he no longer gets paid. Of course, there's been a tradition of restoring and back paying him and other employees that this affects. But I also thought it was interesting that yesterday, when this threat was being made to the Democrats, that we got reporting that a lot of the DOGE cuts that happened earlier this year were being reversed, that people are being re-offered their jobs, they're being asked to come back. Contracts, rental agreements are also being reversed where those government workers were housed. So is this threat something that's feasible when obviously we need government workers to continue all of these vital programs that are necessary? GIS, there's a hurricane brewing out in the Atlantic Ocean right now. We need people to watch and monitor those weather service and untold many, many departments that this affects. So I think that the Democrats are going to hold firm on this. I think that this will result in a shutdown just because the timing of when people will be in D.C. The Senate's going to come back on Monday. We'll see if Speaker Johnson brings the House back because they're in recess. So this is of course, anything can happen this weekend, but no one's talking either. There was supposed to be conversations this week that President Trump canceled with Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries. They have made statements. We're ready to talk. We're ready. We're here. I think Chuck Schumer even said, it was kind of funny, we'll meet you on the golf course if that's what it takes. So they need to talk, but Trump is instructing Congress to not talk to their Democratic colleagues. So if we're not going to talk, we're not going to get anywhere. And what the Democrats are leveraging is does hit more than just government employees. It's healthcare, and it's the data is there that this is going to harm millions and millions of Americans with the rollbacks on Medicaid and these Obamacare extensions. And so I think that they politically see that as, of course, so they're going to get blamed. They get blamed for everything. So if you're going to blame the Democrats, at least they can go home and say, we're fighting for your health care, for grandma's health care, mom and dad's health care. That's a valid argument to go back and make to their constituents.
I yield the 2 minutes before the break to the gentleman from Kinderhook.
Oh. Well, I think this is illustrative of the acute dysfunctional moment we're in. You know, Aaron mentioned this is something that we're talking about all the time. And the data show that this specter of government shutdown is largely a modern phenomenon. It's most particularly the prevalence of it. And I see this is related to the previous issue. This is correlated with the imperial presidency. You know, by design, Article 1 provides this responsibility to the people's representatives, and they are by design to work together. As Ashley pointed out, they're not even talking. I mean, this is like dereliction of duty, and what they're most concerned about or most wanting to do is blame the other side. We should not tolerate this, we the people. I mean, this has got to end. It will only end if we rebalance power in this country and the members of Congress reassume their responsibilities for the power of the purse, for the solemn decision on the use of force, even on matters of regulation, which they've largely yielded to the executive branch. All of these things, these major decisions, were meant to be political questions of which the respective leaders dialogue, they debate, they ultimately reach accommodation, and then we're served that way. But we're not served by the disruption that we've been seeing. Aaron pointed out the economic impacts. You know, there are also foreign policy impacts. We look like clowns. So, you know, here's to better days. And it's going to start with us demanding it.
We'll take a break. We'll talk more and we'll continue the conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. First, we have a few messages and then we'll go over to Lockbox Central right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a good one going. Ashley Dittus is with us, Chris Gibson, Aaron Pasitti, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I want to get to our final topic of the morning. Before I do, we do have a letter from David, which brings up another issue, which I think is important. He is talking in regards to an inevitable government shutdown, but asks, I think, a very important question, which is, what do we make and what are we to make of Pete Hegseth calling in all flag officers in the middle of an almost inevitable government shutdown? What implications could that have? Are we looking at a possible military takeover? It seems incredibly ominous. This has been making news that all of the military higher-ups are being summoned to Washington, D.C. for next week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of another time in my lifetime where this happened, but I want to caution everyone here. There's certainly reason for passion in every direction, and there's spirited debate clearly going on in America, but I don't know at this point if it's helpful to us to start moving towards catastrophizing thoughts on this. Look, I will say in my whole 29 years in the military, I don't believe that happened one time, especially now that we have the ability to do remote meetings where people can all get on the same channel, whether it be Teams or
you can even bring your
Signal.
Family on.
Yeah. So it is, I mean, if you're asking me if I'm surprised, yeah, I'm surprised. But I don't want to read too much into it. We have a constitution. The military is inculcated in civil-military relations. They're aware of their responsibilities attendant to law and constitution. So I know how this goes when you get into emotional moments that you can tend to move towards catastrophizing thoughts, but I'm not gonna do that for myself, and I would not recommend it for anybody else. Be vigilant, of course, we all do as citizens, but we'll see what this is to come.
Tom writes, two words on chronic shutdown dysfunction, Newt Gingrich. Mm. Then we go to this letter from Barbara. Are the looming shutdown and the Comey indictment intentional distractions from Hegseth's military call-up? This call-up of hundreds of military leaders scares me the most. So I think we've addressed all that, but those are some of the comments that we're getting this morning. I want to move on to another topic as we roll through this morning, and that is on voter data. The DOJ announced, this is from Politico, the Department of Justice is suing six additional states to compel them to share their statewide voter registration lists with the federal government, an unusual request that has drawn pushback from election officials in both parties in the past. DOJ's Civil Rights Division filed federal lawsuits yesterday against election officials in California, New York, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, and New Hampshire, claiming the states violated federal law by refusing to share voter rolls with the Trump administration. Access to voting rolls varies state by state, but the rolls are generally released to the public and government agencies with voters' private data, like driver's license numbers or the last four digits of your Social Security numbers, redacted. The DOJ's lawsuit demands the rolls with that data included. Similar requests have been rebuffed by election officials across the country, both recently and in past years, out of privacy concerns and opposition to federal encroachment in state elections. So with a County Board of Elections commissioner in our studio, it seems only fitting to ask what you make of this lawsuit and this story.
Thank you. Yeah, this is obviously near and dear to my heart as someone who works every day to maintain the voter rolls for our voters in Ulster County. So New York is listed in this lawsuit. I want to take you back to August when the DOJ sent the state of New York a list of 14 questions, of which the New York State Board of Elections executive directors who work in a bipartisan fashion, a Democrat executive director and a Republican executive director, much like I do in Ulster County with my Republican counterpart, they responded to those questions and affirmed that the state of New York does comply with federal laws, HAVA, the Help America Vote Act. We've been doing so since the implementation of that law in the late 2000s. So this is, I think, the DOJ, much like we talked about at the top of the conversation with Comey, exerting their authority and making a case against the way that we run our elections in this country. We have very good voter rolls in New York State. We won really good elections. I want to make it clear to your listeners that the voter roll and what they're looking for would include data that is protected by the state of New York in election law and public officers law. We cannot release data on the voter roll that includes the Social Security and the driver's license information. It is something that we retain internally, and it's how we verify voters' ID. So giving it to the federal government is a lot of issues with that. The voter rolls are worked on every single day that we are making changes when voters submit updates to their record or register. If we give that to the federal government, it's a static picture of when they request it. It's constantly being changed. So if you're going to use old data and use it to say that somebody wasn't qualified to vote, well, you're not getting the update that happened in between the last time you got the file and when you're asserting that claim. But we've seen the DOJ act in other ways against our election system. Homeland Security is now doing more frequent subpoenas to boards of elections, including mine, looking for specific voters' data that they are alleging is a non-citizen. So they're doing that all across the state of New York.
Is that what they're looking for?
Yes, at least in our case, the agent did speak to the press, to the Times Union, and said that they were looking and investigating a voter fraud claim on our voter. There have been other claims, Dutchess County, Saratoga County. So if their intent is to, with the voter rolls, to make a nationwide voter registry, then they're not also going to do the work of updating the voter roll and getting that information in real time. This is also the same administration that has cut four boards of elections access to cybersecurity infrastructure at the DHS level. We used to have alerts that were specific to the work that we're doing, cyber threats coming our way, working with our IT departments. Those, all of those jobs were cut in DOGE. They are not being restored. And so it's back on the states to fill in those gaps, but it's much harder to fill in the gaps on the state level when this is an interconnected system across the country. So if we're trying to make our elections safer and more secure, then we should bring back things like that.
You know, that is what a great point. It strikes me, I was listening to the comment by Pam Bondi yesterday on this, and I thought, this is what's so interesting so often about this administration. This was the case with the first go-around and with this administration as well, is that so often their answer and their press release sounds like what the other side would say. You know, and meaning, so Pam Bondi said, clean voter rolls are the foundation of free and fair elections. Every state has a responsibility to ensure that voter registration records are accurate, accessible, and secure. Right.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Absolutely agree.
So don't start sharing them around, right?
Yeah, exactly. Don't start sharing them around. And then don't the political motivation is where this is all rooted. We have a president who is obsessed with the fact that he lost in 2020 and asserts that that was from election interference when there is no evidence that shows that that is the case. It's that obsession in the DOJ now shifting from working for us to working for Donald Trump and satisfying his retribution campaign. And then that's going to harm. And what I look at this is, you know, I talk to voters every single day and they say to me, you know what? I read the news, but we're good here. Everything is good in Ulster County. I can trust my election system here. And I'm like, yes, you can. But you should also be able to trust it everywhere else, because what you're saying, all the election officials I talk to, they say their voters say to them. So where is it not working?
Right. Chris?
Well, in relation to the founding principles in here that relate to federalism, the Constitution provides that states shall administer the elections. This does appear on its face aggressive. What I'm watching for is Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. I'm aware that the Republican Secretary of State in Pennsylvania was appointed by a Democratic governor. I'm aware of that. But I'm watching the words there of Al Schmidt, and he believes that the DOJ's request is unlawful. We just heard from Ashley. I haven't heard yet from Governor Ayotte in New Hampshire. I'm going to be watching that closely to see where we are. But the spirit of what we were intended to do was to have co-sovereignty with states. And unless we change the Constitution, it does seem like an overreach. And I think that's a unifying theme here When you look at all these issues, we looked at whether it be Comey or the specter of a government shutdown or even, you know, the meeting of generals and now voter data. I would say that none of these issues didn't just show up, and as we know, in 2025. And if you're interested in learning more, you know, I do go into great detail in my book, The Spirit of Philadelphia. Go to your local public library and check it out and read it and let me know what you think, if we can dialogue about it if you're interested. But I think that, you know, you're going to see states defend what they perceive as their constitutional rights to administer. And particularly since what Schmidt was saying is, look, any kind of request has to come with some kind of stipulation from the federal government that why they need the data and how they assure the privacy will be upheld. So that's some of the reporting here, is that there's been no comment from the DOJ when it comes to this.
Right. As to why. Aaron.
Yeah, I think the nature of the data being requested is insane. I mean, you're asking for some of the most. I mean, why not ask for their credit card numbers and their bank account routing number and the CVC number? You know, I think it's pretty clear that if the federal government has access to this information, it's not going to be well protected. It's not going to be used in a way that is going to serve any purpose aside from having it used to get Republicans elected in the future. The other interesting thing, and maybe Ashley could comment on this, the first thing that jumped out at me was, why does the federal government need people's Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers? But, you know, the states, California, New York, Minnesota, and New Hampshire all voted blue in the 2024 election, and Michigan and Pennsylvania voted red, but they're obviously swing states and very important swing states. So I wonder how much of this is motivated by some type of political calculus in the future. And Chris's point about federalism, that, you know, there's states do have certain rights and they're granted those rights by the federal government. You know, this just seems in the era of the imperial presidency that, yeah, it really doesn't matter if Trump wants it to. If Trump wants it to be a strong autocratic federal rule, then that's what it's going to be, independent of what the Constitution says, independent of what powers the Constitution grants to the federal government. You know, you're looking at calling this administration Republican, I think, does a disservice to Republicans. And as many listeners and probably many of you in the room know, I'm not a Republican, but I feel bad for Republican, like honest to goodness Republicans, because this is not a Republican in office. This is somebody who is, you know, taking shares of private companies, you know, starting to chisel away at the notion of private property rights with these golden shares in Intel and perhaps U.S. Steel. So, yeah, there's no precedent for this, which Chris alluded to. And I think we're just in for another 3 years of, well, what's next? What else is going to happen that there's no precedent for? And how's it going to turn out? And I don't think anyone has the answer for that. But the question I want to go back to for Ashley is, like, is there something unique about the six states that were mentioned, or do you think this is just another political move, like going after Comey, who's the next person on Trump's enemies list?
Yeah, sure. It does seem political in nature to me. That's from the outside looking in. I think, you know, they're trying to prove that hordes of undocumented people voted in the 2020 election. That's where this is generally just understood to be rooted. And they can't prove that because it didn't happen. So they're trying to make this case that the boards or whoever runs the elections, whether that's Secretary of State in all these different states, have something to hide, that they're not being forthcoming. We are happy to provide the voter data minus those pieces of information.
Right.
Those are very widely available. It's why everybody complains that they get phone calls all election cycle, and why their mailbox is clogged with mailers. So that's where this is coming from. And they have the microphone. So it's people like me that have to talk about what the facts are.
Chris, we got about 20 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate what Aaron said. I'm conflicted about it, frankly, because on the one hand, I want to show respect to the American people, 330 million Americans. Donald Trump was elected by a majority, many of them Republicans. So You know, there is that. We want to respect the American voter. But on the other hand, it's undeniable that this is not conservatism versus liberalism. This is Trump versus anti-Trump. And right. and what's coming mm-hmm. forward in this administration is not what you would see in, say, a Reagan administration. It's just not the case. So I am conflicted. But I do think there is a way forward. But we need to appeal to all Americans to look towards the Constitution and reset power.
I would call this a damn good show. Thank you all for being so wonderful, so thoughtful, and such an expert in your respective issues. I so appreciate it. I hope you have a beautiful weekend, and I can't thank you enough for being here. Chris Gibson, thank you. Ashley Dittus and Aaron Pacitti, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well.
Best wishes to the listeners, too.
Right back after this.